first episode of the Culture Vacuum Podcast. We're talking San Diego Comic-Con, Jake Paul, and much more. So sit back, relax, and get sucked in. Welcome, welcome, one and all, to the very first episode of the Culture Vacuum Podcast, the official podcast of culturevacuum.com. I'm your host, Samuel Pollet, and the first thing I like to do here is just let you guys know, welcome to the podcast first, thank you for listening, but I want to just let you know my thoughts of why I'm bothering creating this podcast. So I started culturevacuum.com a few weeks ago, put some reviews up there, think pieces, and I like those a lot because I like sitting down, writing, that kind of thing. But I felt that I still wanted to comment on more topical stories, comment on the news of the past week, stuff like that, and also bring in other voices for conversations. And that's not something you can really do on a blog. I don't want my blog to be, oh, here's what happened this week in news, because I'm just constantly writing, I'm constantly responding to every single story. I always have to come up with some kind of unique angle. And with this podcast, I can just look at the stories, come up with my thoughts on the fly. Nothing super serious, just to give you my general opinions on it, but not like draw a super broad conclusion. Because I like Culture Vacuum, the website, to be more philosophical. And there's definitely going to be societal philosophy related to film and TV on this podcast. But I felt that I should reserve some of that for the blog as well. And also, I like talking about the news. So That's pretty much my thoughts about why I created this podcast. Also, conversations, like I have an interview with my friend Michael that I'm going to show today, and then I'm working on a bigger piece about Beats Music that I'm hoping to air either next week or the week after that. Depends on how my production schedule looks. But let's get into the news of the week. And the first bit of news we have is San Diego Comic-Con has been this past weekend. As you're listening to this, a ton of stuff has happened. And I'm recording this as late as I can Sunday to make sure I'm reporting on as much news as I possibly can. And sort of hanging over San Diego Comic-Con was this report coming out of The Hollywood Reporter saying that Ben Affleck and Warner Brothers are preparing for his departure. Warner's pursuing, oh, are they going to make another character Batman, cast other actors Batman, or they're exploring options. And this sort of reflects other sentiments of Ben was directing Batman, now he's not directing Batman, but he was still going to have his script. And then they threw his script out the window. So there's a lot hanging over this movie, and I can't blame Ben Affleck, because as good as I think he is as Batman, I don't really think those movies he's been in are as good. Now, Wonder Woman is the exception here. Man of Steel is okay, but Batman vs. Superman is a befuddled mess. There's a lot to like in it, but I think the movie itself is just not very good. And I don't really blame him for wanting out. Like, no one wants to be affiliated with a bad franchise. Our second story is we got a ton of trailers out of Comic-Con. Three in particular I want to talk about. First is Thor, the new Thor Ragnarok trailer, the Justice League, and Stranger Things. Let's start with Stranger Things. I liked Stranger Things Season 1 a lot. I'm not the super fan that most people are of it, but I still think it was a pretty good show, and I'm glad Netflix is looking like they're going to make very creative content, and just it's what they've always been doing, which I think Stranger Things was the higher quality things they've been putting out. The Season 2 trailer, it's set to Michael Jackson's Thriller. We see what looks like a gigantic Demogorgon. We see Will Byers is just drifting in and out of the Upside Down. And it seems that he has some kind of connection with Eleven. I think this trailer looks really good. You should, of course, check it out for yourself. And I think Stranger Things Season 2 comes in October, so only have a few more months left to wait for it. Next trailer I want to talk about was the new Thor Ragnarok trailer. Now, I've never been a fan of the Thor movies. Like, the first one I thought was okay. The second Thor the Dark World, was just boring. Just so boring. Of course, Tom Hiddleston was good in it, but, like, the movie just didn't seem important. Like, it didn't seem like it bared that much weight in the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe. I would have liked it if it did, but it was just a dull movie, just filler. It was fine. It was forgettable. This new Thor, though, looks very good. The director, Taika Waititi, made one of my favorite mockumentaries called What We Do in the Shadows. It's a mockumentary about vampires living in New Zealand. Utterly hysterical. And I think, judging from this trailer, his sense of humor is playing a lot to it. Another highlight of it is Tessa Thompson. For those of you who don't know who she is, you may have seen her. She was the love interest in Creed. She was good in Creed, but I didn't think she was particularly good. She wasn't particularly a standout performance in it compared to what we saw from Adonis Creed and Rocky, of course, played by Michael B. Jordan and Sylvester Stallone. But in this trailer, she has this sexy vibe to her, just like the way she looks at things. She has this fun persona about her. She just has this confident walk. I think what they've done with this character of the Valkyrie, which is who she's playing, they've just done a great job with it. And I think she and Thor are going to have a great dynamic. And I hope they don't force the love interest on it and they're just people who cooperate with each other. I think that'd be something really interesting to see. Now, of course, I think the highlight of this trailer, though, wasn't Cate Blanchett, who looks great as Hela, but they didn't really focus on too much. And Chris Hemsworth looks good as Thor. I think, of course, the highlight I think everyone's going to remember is the Hulk. The Hulk, guys, is finally talking in coherent sentences. This is what we have been waiting for in a Hulk movie, because if you read comic books, you know sometimes Hulk can talk, sometimes he can't. It just depends what the plot requires. I like what they've done with Hulk in here. Like his sense, like is they've sort of taken that bromance, that violent bromance that he and Thor had in the first Avengers, and just they've taken it over to here. I really like it. I really think Hulk's going to do a lot of great stuff in this movie, and I really think he's going to steal the show. The last trailer I want to talk about today was the first, like, real big look into Justice League. They put out a 4-minute-long trailer, which is just, that's too much trailer. Come on. But it opens with a pretty long sequence of Wonder Woman saving the day, because Wonder Woman was the breakout hit. You gotta open your trailer with Wonder Woman. And then we see The Flash, we see Cyborg, we see Aquaman, we see the whole league teaming up together. We see Steppenwolf for the first time. He's played by Ciaran Hinds from Game of Thrones. He played Caesar in the HBO series Rome. He's a good actor. And then we see a lot of great looking action, tons of special effects. I am more excited for Justice League than I've been recently, but I'm still cautiously optimistic. All respect to Zack Snyder, because he's gone through some personal tragedy, but his most recent work has not instilled confidence in me. It's looking like Justice League will be good, but Batman vs. Superman looked good. Suicide Squad looked great. Both of those turned out to be big piles of garbage. So there's a lot to look at it. I'm still cautiously optimistic for this movie, but I'm going to see it. I like what DC has done with Wonder Woman, but side note is that at their conference, they announced a bunch of other upcoming movies, including Shazam, Green Lantern Corps, The Flash, which is now the Flashpoint storyline from the comics. I don't know why they're bothering doing that. It doesn't look like DC has a solid plan of what they want to do with their universe, and that's what concerns me. So Justice League may be great, but I don't think DC knows what they want to do yet, and that's what's concerning, but the trailer looks good. The movie's looking better than I thought it would be, but it's a Warner Brothers movie. Their marketing department is very good at making shit look like gold. Okay, so those are the end of the trailers I want to talk about. Another sort of like a sleeper interesting story that came out of Comic-Con was Bright, Netflix's first big budget movie. It's a $100 million budget, directed by David Ayer, who directed End of Watch and Suicide Squad, second one. The script was penned by Max Landis. He wrote Chronicle, which is one of my favorite super small superhero stories. I love that movie. It's a found footage superhero story. It's really good. You should see it. But Bright, the trailer, it's pretty crazy. We see Will Smith. He's just living in suburban Los Angeles. There's just fairies, because in this world, fairies and monsters and orcs, they're all real, and they live alongside humans. And Will Smith, we see him beating a fairy out of his bug catcher. It's pretty funny stuff. And then we see he's a cop who works for the LAPD, and he's partnered with an orc who they call a diversity hire, and he doesn't like magical creatures, but, you know, he's a cop, he'll do his job. And then they find a magic wand, and in this world, magic wands are both rare and extremely powerful. The trailer is really good, but that's not really what I wanted to talk about with Bright, is that this is the envisioning of what Netflix wants to do with original content. Because when they first started making original series, their goal was, we need to make as much content as we possibly can and build a catalog of shows that people love as fast as possible so that we can compete with HBO. They have that now. House of Cards, I didn't like the most recent season of House of Cards, but it's their biggest show. Orange is the New Black is a hit, even though the most recent season has gotten terrible reviews. They, of course, have all their Marvel shows. They have BoJack Horseman, which I adore. They have tons of great original material under their belt. And now Netflix is sort of being like, we need to take risks. And in order to take risks, we need to free up money. So that's why they've been axing shows that underperform. Bloodline, which the first season I enjoyed quite a bit. Bloodline got canceled after season 3. Sense8 got canceled after season 2. The Get Down, which was Netflix's most important show to date, The Get Down got canceled after just one season. There were a lot of reasons behind it, but the Netflix strategy used to be give as much money to as many people as possible and have them make whatever they want. Now it's give money to people to make the first season of whatever they want, but if that first season doesn't underperform, we'll say, thank you for your work, we'll see you now. That's like, we saw shows like Girl Boss, which I didn't watch Girl Boss, but the reviews weren't very good for it. It didn't seem like it appealed to me, and not a lot of people watched it, so Netflix canceled it after season 1. I tend to defend Netflix on this because there should be a platform out there that takes risks on creatives. And risk means you sometimes fall. Netflix is fine giving $10 million to someone to make a season of television, but if they don't get their return, instead of being mad, they'll be like, no, we're not going to keep trying. You're done. You had your chance. Thank you very much for what you did. I don't think that's a bad thing. And The Get Down, as much as people love The Get Down, this show cost $120 million. Estimates are this show cost between $120 to $200 million to produce season 1. And then after season 1, the creator of the show, Baz Luhrmann, left. And then it just didn't have people who watched it. Any company would be out of their mind to produce season 1 of that show, let alone give it a second season. The fans of The Get Down are frankly lucky that Netflix gave them that first season after the price of that first season started to balloon and balloon and balloon, and they were fine giving out the money for that first season, but people didn't watch it. Ultimately, they're a business. They need to make money. That's where I stand on this, and I'm glad that they're axing shows that don't perform because this means they can take more risks on movies. They have this deal with Adam Sandler, but Bright cost $100 million. So if you're Netflix and Netflix spends more money on content than any studio, I think for 2017 they're planning on spending more than $2 billion on shows, but still, they have a limited budget. If you're planning on spending $2 billion for content, and let's say half of that, very generous estimate, let's say half of that is reserved for shows you're currently producing, and you only have season 2 of The Get Down, which could cost $200 million, or you have Bright, which is something you haven't tried yet, which is a big budget original film that could take $100 million, you're going to go for Bright. You're going to take the risk on something that could work or could not work. You already gave The Get Down its chance. You already gave Sense8 its chance. If it doesn't give you the returns you're looking for, free up that money and take a risk on something else. I think it's actually really admirable. I think it's like the best of both worlds. It sucks when shows you like get canceled. For me, they had a show called Hemlock Grove that I actually liked a lot, but no one watched it. I was one of 5 people who watched that show. I understood why it got canceled. I was sad they weren't going to make more of it, but I understood that. So that's my thoughts on Netflix. Bright is sort of, you know, the framing of that. Okay, we've now come to a segment called The Soapbox, which is where I rant about something that is just bothering me. This can be anything, a trend I'm seeing that I think is stupid, but our soapbox for this week is the official box office numbers have come in for this week. Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk, which I wrote a review of, you can see, did very well for the kind of movie that it was. I think it's going to have decent legs and make a good bit of money. The big story of the box office this week is Valerian in the City of a Thousand Planets, starring Damien Dahan and Cara Delevingne, directed by Luc Besson, same director who did The Fifth Element and Lucy. This movie cost $209 million to make, probably cost $100 million to market, let alone everything else around this, the cost of this movie. This movie made, and I kid you not, $16 million in its opening weekend. That is catastrophic. This is the kind of loss that gets a studio executives fired, and it potentially stands to force a studio into bankruptcy or reevaluation or selling their assets. Like, this is not a good situation. And I did not see Valerian. I frankly don't intend on seeing Valerian. This is not going to be about the quality of the film, although the reviews for it haven't been that good. They've been okay. When I looked at the marketing for Valerian, the soapbox is, why did Valerian fail? Why did this movie with a huge budget, Cara Delevingne, who's a rising star, with an established director who's made films that people seem to like, why did this movie bomb so hard? And I really think it comes down to the marketing. This movie is based off a graphic novel. It's a sci-fi movie. The marketing for this movie seemed dull to me. And it all sold it as it's the 3D event of the summer. It's the most beautiful film you've ever seen. But audiences aren't dumb anymore. You can look at movies like Transformers and just to see. We're not fooled by big explosions and bright colors and all sorts of things going on around us. We're not fooled by that anymore. In order for these big, amazing special effects to have any impact on how a film will do, like if you show the special effects in your trailers, you need to care. The Avengers movies are super heavy on special effects, but we care about the characters. In Spider-Man Homecoming, there's a sequence that you see in the trailer where Peter is trying to keep a boat from splitting in half with his webbing, and then he grabs it and he's holding it together with his own strength. That's all special effects and it all looks good, but the reason that we care about that is because everyone recognizes Spider-Man. Everyone cares about Spider-Man. What Valerian failed to do, what the trailers failed to do, is make you care about anything going on screen. If you watch any of the trailers for Valerian, it's a series of seemingly unconnected visual effects shots strung together with text telling you how great Luc Besson is and a little bit of dialogue. I didn't understand what was going on. Sure, it looked good, but I didn't understand what was going on. I didn't know why I should care. There's a scene in the trailer of the hero Valerian. He's using his like portal gun or something to jump on energy discs that he shoots in the air to run around the city. Whatever. I didn't care about that though. Sure, it looked good, but if you don't care about it, people don't care how good the effects look. You can show me a cartoon. If the cartoon is interesting and the characters are compelling from your marketing, I'll care. So the marketing for this movie focus on, look how pretty it is, look how pretty it is, look how pretty it is. And that's fine, but they didn't bother telling us about the story. They didn't bother telling us about the characters. They didn't bother telling us about anything. So I called about a week or two ago. This movie was going to bomb. This movie was going to bomb hard. And I'm not surprised at the amount of money it's going to lose for the studio. I think this should be a lesson. We should have more big budget original films because, yeah, we love Marvel movies, but if you're going to make a big budget original film with lots of special effects, very expensive special effects, when you're marketing it to me, don't show me the pretty colors, because we see pretty colors and great special effects all the time now. Every big budget movie has these kinds of effects. We see these all the time. We're not impressed by it anymore. So if a studio wants me to care, put some of your story in your trailer, because when I looked at Valerian, I'm like, this looks pretty. What happens? I don't think anything happens in this movie. So that is the soapbox for this week. It's one of many rants, I think. I mean, I ranted more, but the soapbox of Valerian was what I wanted to focus on. Now we're going to move on into what I like to call the editorial / discussion section of Culture Vacuum. This is where I like to do long-form conversations about topics in pop culture in general that I think are really interesting to me. This week, I was lucky enough to have my buddy Michael on the show, and he and I talked about We talked about a couple things, but I'm going to save some of it for future episodes. But what you're going to hear is our conversation about Jake Paul, who's this he's one of the biggest YouTubers right now. He's gotten into some hot water lately. As I'm recording this, what we talked about is already out of date because he did even more ridiculous stuff. But what I'm going to talk about, what we talk about is just this kind of character. He's doing a lot of things that are questionable, and it's sort of the modern celebrity isn't a music star. It's a person who lets you into their life through a vlog or something like that. So we talked about Jake Paul for a good bit, and now I'm going to let you into that conversation here. Michael, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty great, Samuel. It's good to be back on the interwaves with you.
Yeah, on the new show.
The new show. This one's new and different.
I guess to start, it's like, Unwatchable isn't dead. Unwatchable is going through a metamorphosis right now.
Yeah, we're sort of just like trying to figure out, you know, what it's gonna be and what, you know,
it's in its podcast cocoon. It.
Yeah, it's evolving into a more whole and complete and
coherent
version of itself. You know.
Yeah. And and it'll come out of that cocoon around the summer. But I wanted to start Culture Vacuum off with talking with an Unwatchable host, of course, because you got all the insights. And oh, by God, this microphone you're using sounds so nice.
Yeah, shout out to my roommate for letting me use his really nice microphone.
Yeah, it just sounds beautiful. Both ends are going to sound very goodly.
Nice. That's not a word. Nice and crisp and clear.
Let's go to good old Jake Paul.
Oh boy.
For those old people listening to this podcast, hi. How's Medicare? How's Medicare? Is it good? Do you like it?
Has Trump taken it away yet? Who knows?
Glad to hear. Jake Paul and Logan Paul, they're these people who exist on this platform called Vine where you make 6-second sketches and they're sort of funny.
Yep.
Vine got shut down because it ran out of money.
Yep.
So all the Vine stars immediately jumped over to YouTube. By far the most successful of these Vine stars in terms of financial success, followers, are the Paul brothers, Jake and Logan. And Logan Paul, you know, I don't mind him. He is what he is. I think that stunt he pulled at VidCon where he hid thousands of dollars and caused mass hysteria was dumb, but for the most part, Logan Paul is the tamer of the Paul brothers.
Yeah.
Jake Paul is his little baby brother, who, just for reference, is less than a year older than Michael and myself.
Yep.
And when you look at the numbers on his channel, that his channel gets, and you look at, and you have a vague idea of what kind of money YouTube pays out, this child who was born, oh God, this is sad. He was born 7 months before me. This man is making at minimum
$1 million
a month. At minimum.
Damn.
A month.
Yeah.
That's at minimum. If he's making the numbers that these family-friendly YouTubers make, he could be making $5 to $6 million a month.
Not to even mention that he's making Disney money on top of that.
Disney doesn't pay their stars that much. Like, when you look at, they tend to cancel their shows before the stars get too big, unless the numbers justify it.
Right.
But still, yeah, it's like, he's making some money for Disney, but he's making at least $1 million a month from his YouTube career, plus whatever brand, I don't know if he does branding on his channel or not, but he has his own brand as well. But just, the guy's making a lot of money. And when you give a 20-year-old a lot of money, it turns out they don't make good decisions.
Nope.
Oh, God. So the most recent event was he rents a house, because that's what rich YouTubers do in Los Angeles. He rents a house in Los Angeles in the neighborhood of West Hollywood, which is a affluent neighborhood, but it's very quiet. And he and his goon squad have just they've been doing all their pranks and stunts, not away from the house, but in the house. And not only are they doing it their stunts in the house, Jake Paul, the Paul brothers, their followers are almost exclusively young girls, which we can hint at the issues with that later. But their followers. He's published where his house is on Google. You can Google where his address is, yeah, and just go hang outside his house and hope he shows up.
Yep.
So this quiet neighborhood is not only filled with just a bunch of young guys pulling pranks and stunts on each other, but also the streets are flooded with prepubescent girls trying to get a snap of Jake Paul.
Yeah.
And I showed Michael this news clip where Jake did an interview. Michael, what are your thoughts on this whole situation?
Yeah, well, it just seems like a very Project X type of thing going on with this neighborhood right now. You know, you've got these crazy kids. They're setting fires in the pools. They're parking their cars all crooked in the driveway and being loud and obnoxious, climbing on all that news equipment and whatnot. And it just seems like if I was a homeowner in that neighborhood, I would not be very happy with it, with the situation.
Cause yeah,
he seems like it's one thing to like file a noise complaint for a party, you know, but it's another thing to like
when the party never ends.
Yeah, and there's not even a party. It's just, oh, me and my friends are bored today. We're just gonna go fuck up some shit. Like, you know, like there's no drive behind it except for, oh, it'll get me more famous or people will think it's funny.
Yeah, and the reason I wanted to talk about it was like, you can't deny this guy isn't culturally relevant. And this is the culture vacuum. We suck in all the culture.
Yeah.
Big ol' suck with a capital C.
What we're here for. We're the Dyson of the culture podcasts.
Yeah, it's like he and his brother are what little girls watch online now. And I assume little boys.
That sounds so creepy to say.
That was purposefully creepy because, yeah, like, I don't want to presume. I don't want to accuse him of a crime he hasn't committed. But he doesn't seem like the way he acts publicly does not make it seem like he understands the power dynamic in the relationship between a fan and the person they're a fan of.
Yeah.
And the amount of fire he is playing with, letting these young women who are, some of them no older than 15, letting these young women know where he lives and encouraging them to come hang out by his house.
Yeah.
There is a very, it's not funny, but it's a potentially very bad decision. Whether or not he does anything, he is opening himself up to this kind. Like, let's assume he's entirely innocent. He has no bad intentions with these girls. Their mothers may not say the same. Like, right, their mothers may see this as a way to get money out of this man. And exactly, they'll use their daughters as a pawn. Or their mothers or fathers, parents, whatever. Their families may see this as a way to take advantage of him. And that's me giving him the benefit of the doubt. But this is why you don't let your, this is why you keep your fans at an arm's length. You interact with them in comments and public forums and you behave yourself.
Right.
I don't think, I don't know the man. He might be entirely innocent, but it's not a good sign when you as a famous person are actively encouraging your fans to come to your house.
Right.
That's where I will leave it because I don't want to get into libel or slander or any of that, but
yeah, but yeah, it's just the whole thing has very very strange Busy Bill vibe, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, for those unwatchable fans listening. Yeah, like, looking at the more positive side of it, the more relevant side, like Casey Neistat has and Philip DeFranco, those kinds of guys, they've risen to the old class, the old guard of YouTube viewers like you and me.
Yep.
The old guard of YouTube viewers watch people like Casey Neistat and Philip DeFranco. The new guard of YouTube viewers, they watch people like the Paul brothers. And I think it's interesting when, like, people like Casey and Philip DeFranco are very careful in how they behave in public. And they're very careful in how they interact with fans because they understand that dynamic. Because they are pretty old people themselves.
Right.
The Paul brothers, I don't know if they understand that kind of dynamic and how to behave themselves. Eventually, they will run out of money, and maybe that will be their the knock on the door that they need to behave differently. But
yeah, well, I think Casey Neistat did a video where he talked about it with I can't remember who. Did he talk about it on the podcast with?
He talked about it on his vlog. He talked about the Paul brothers on his vlog.
Okay. Yeah. So I think he talked about it on the podcast with DeFranco too. But anyways, he was talking about how every sort of YouTube genre fad that has come about has reached a point of, you know, outrageousness and outlandishness to where something else comes and takes its place. So for example, you had the Let's Players, and you know, eventually you had people like Leafy Is Here and these other sort of you know, anti-SJW types come in and sort of, you know, take over that. And that was the sort of outlandish peak of mm-hmm. Let's Players.
The thing with Let's Plays shifted to existing primarily on Twitch because the economics are better there.
Right, exactly. But after that it was pranks. And pranks were the new thing. And you had, like, prank versus prank. And you had Roman Atwood. And you had, like,
boyfriend versus girlfriend.
You know, yeah, exactly. So that's prank versus prank. But then you had people like Joey Salad coming out and doing these, you know, super, super rapey and, you know, sexual assaulty vibe type of pranks where he's kissing and then there girls was the, in public.
There's also Prank Invasion where those pranks are clearly faked.
Right. And then there was Sam Smith, or not Sam Smith, Sam, whatever the fuck his name is.
The guy who did the fake murder, the fake execution prank. That was...
Yeah, that was fucked up. I still can't watch that video without getting really pissed.
Yeah, but like, the prank itself was fake. The guy didn't actually think his friend was going to die.
I am not sure about that one, but...
It was a fake... All YouTube pranks are fake, Michael. You need to know. You need to understand that.
Wow, I just took the red pill. I'm a new man. I see everything differently now. Everything is real. Art is a lie.
All pranks are clearly fake. The reason that people took out against that video, though, is like it was a very traumatic thing to watch, and not all viewers know that it's fake, even though like smart people know it's fake.
Right. Well, I was not one of the smart people who knew.
It was you're a smart person, but you just you're still in the blue pill, man. You need to take that red pill.
Yeah, I gotta wake up to the world around me, dude.
You gotta realize that Israel's behind everything, man. You gotta realize.
But yeah, like I was saying, you know, like then it was pranks and that now it's vlogs. And I think Jake Paul and Logan Paul are that sort of, you know, push that vlogs are going to have that's going to take it over the top, that is going to usher eventually, in whatever is new.
The Paul, but the, so like, do you watch Game Theory?
Not really, but that's so, just a theory, a game theory.
Yeah, so Game Theory, he'll do YouTube analysis videos every once in a while, and his most recent YouTube analysis was on the Paul brothers. And what he did was, like, the Paul brothers aren't just vloggers. They've mobilized their community to create a cycle that increases both their views. So when Jake Paul makes Everyday Bro, which I still believe is a purposefully terrible music video.
Yeah. I think so.
He creates this purposefully terrible music video so that Logan's like, hey, baby brother, you're an idiot. So he creates this feud, which is completely orchestrated between the two of them. Of course. So they both create response videos to each other, which means you gotta watch Jake's and then you gotta watch Logan's and you gotta watch Jake's and you gotta watch Logan's. The whole thing is, their whole relationship is designed to create this vacuum just between the two of them. So it's not about the vlogs, it's these two brothers in a vlog,
right.
And then a meteor hits.
And then a meteor hits. Oh, man.
It's these two brothers who are just regular brothers.
That are...
I can't stop. Stop me. Internet. Stop me, Michael. Here's the subject.
Stop it, Samuel.
Here's the subject. I can't stop quoting Rick and Morty.
Rick and Morty's coming back.
I know. Yeah. But no, so it's these two brothers creating this cycle of views and... Their communities, they're little girls, these little people, they don't have fully developed brains yet. They don't know that all this is fake, that yeah. Logan and Jake Paul are just playing them to make millions more dollars.
But playing them like a small, helpless fiddle.
A small, helpless, prepubescent fiddle.
God damn it. We need to stop.
Jake, move and don't tell people where you live. Jake, if you're listening and you're not, don't. You're putting yourself in a bad situation here. You want to remove yourself from.
Yeah.
I will leave it at that.
It's actually very dangerous that he tells people where he lives.
Yeah, it's like not even he's opening himself up to like not let's let alone the fact of like some crazy parent could manipulate their daughter to get money out of Jake Paul. Let's ignore that. People could send a car bomb to his house. Like
people could do a lot of things.
There are maniacs out of here. Someone read Catcher in the Rye and decided to kill John Lennon.
Well, and especially if like your brand and the whole thing that he's going for, which is pretty clear, is to be out there and sort of provocative and offensive to a point.
Like what if someone's prank is let's kill Jake Paul?
Yeah, like if you're gonna be that type of voice on the internet, you can't also be public about it. There's a reason why, I'm trying to think of other like provocative YouTubers. I don't know,
FoozyTube.
Yeah, FoozyTube. There's a reason why, like, FoozyTube and PewDiePie don't put their places of living on the internet because
PewDiePie has an office to record. PewDiePie has an office to record in.
Yeah.
Most of his content is not recorded in his house. His content is recorded in an office studio. Like, he's completely separated from his place of living. And every time you see his house, it's only the interior. You don't see enough of the outside to pinpoint where he lives. Like, you can find where PewDiePie lives if you want to. You can find where H3H3 lives if you want to. But the fact that they don't actively encourage to find them is why they keep themselves safe. Like, it's just covering your bases.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's like, I think it's important. It's interesting that this new generation of YouTube viewers has flocked to these two brothers and the people like them and the people around them.
Yeah.
And that's why I think it's relevant to talk about them. So when they do stir up controversy, it's just to get more views. I understand that. But it's still the fact of in the real world, outside of whatever persona they put on, they're encouraging people to come to their house. That is not safe. And that brings us to what is going to be the last big segment of the show today, our Game of Thrones discussion. We're not going to do regular updates of Game of Thrones on the podcast. I'll be writing reviews in the blog. In fact, my review of episode 2 of season 7 should be up on Culture Vacuum as you're hearing this. So go to culturevacuum.com if you're wondering what my thoughts are on the series so far. But what Michael and I talked about was more, what are we excited for? What do we think is going to happen in this season? Just the crazy predictions, because at the time we spoke, we had seen episode 1, and we had had time to reflect on the series as a whole. And with Game of Thrones coming to an end, we really just wanted to sit back and take a look. What's going to be the future of Game of Thrones? What are we looking forward to? What do we think is going to happen? What kind of twists? So let's go into our Game of Thrones discussion. And of course, spoilers for the entire series if you have not seen it yet.
Dum dum da da dum dum da da dum dum da da dum dum.
It's back, and it's better than ever, and by the time this airs, we will have only seen episode 2 will be out, but we will have seen episode 1.
Yep.
And I might include my personal thoughts on episode 2, but so let's not talk about like the specifics of the episode, but just the season in general. It's back. What are you excited for?
I am excited for the different power sort of, I'm trying to think of a word. Alliances that are gonna form, we already saw in the first episode, the Lannisters are spoilers, of course, by the way, if you haven't assumed or figured that out. The Lannisters are trying to work with Euron Greyjoy, and I'm really interested to see the different dynamics and stuff of who works with who and what people can provide to the different parties of the Game of Thrones.
Yeah, Euron Greyjoy. Jesus, Euron Greyjoy is going to be a.
Oh hey, I brought some ships.
Euron Greyjoy is someone I'm looking forward to witnessing how they planned all this. But what's it's Jon Snow said it best in the premiere. It's like I'm focused on the war to come. The war is coming for us. The White Walkers. Yeah. That wall needs to come down.
Yeah.
And I don't know how they're going to do it, but what is your call? Do you think Cersei is dead before or after the White Walkers invade?
Damn. I think if they were... I think Daenerys is gonna come in. She's gonna fuck up some shit. I think that's definitely gonna happen. And I think either Jaime or Cersei or both are going to die.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I would like to see is actually Cersei or Jaime, either one surviving and sort of seeing them on the run, and mm-hmm. you know, in this place on the hierarchy that they've never experienced before, where they're hated and not, you know,
yeah,
you know, on the run basically. So
remind me, Tywin Lannister forged ice Ned Stark's Valyrian steel sword into two smaller Valyrian steel swords. One of them belongs to Brienne of Tarth. Where'd the second one go?
I think Jaime has the other one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, I think that's why I think Jaime survives, because he has Valyrian steel and we need as many of those swords as we can. Like, Jon's focused on finding Dragonglass, but
yeah.
Valyrian steel is still going to be an important part of the battle against the White Walkers.
Right.
So that's why my bet is people are betting that Jaime kills Cersei.
That would be interesting. Oh, and they already nodded to that too, because he was like, You killed your brother to Yorland, and he was like, yeah, felt great. You should try it sometime.
Yeah. So I think like, you know, it's that classic George R. R. Martin twist. Like, we think, oh, Jaime's a man of honor now, and Jaime is a good person. Like, Jaime, when I watched season one, Jaime's a shit person in season one.
Oh, yeah.
But except like his relationship with Tyrion. But
yeah.
But like, he's had a big arc. And since it's George R. R. Martin, I know he's not writing on the show anymore, but it's still like, it's George R. R. Martin, that kind of logic. Mm. I think there's a good chance that Cersei kills Jaime, because the show is not about poetic justice. The show is about leading to poetic justice and then a fucking... blows your mind.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true.
Yeah, so I think Cersei killing Jaime is not something to disregard. Another thing I don't think people should disregard, people are like, oh, Sansa's gonna kill Littlefinger. There's a good chance that Sansa kills Jon.
Yeah. Yeah.
And no one's talking about it, but there's a very good chance that Sansa kills Jon.
Yeah,
like, maybe.
I don't know, like I want to say that, you know, no, that can't happen, but it can, like, it really can.
Yeah. Those are the two big, like, shocker deaths that I think are going to have to happen.
Yeah.
Like, yes, if not, I don't think both of them will happen, but there's a good chance that Jaime doesn't make it out of it because Cersei kills him. Like, if anyone kills Jaime, it's Cersei.
Right.
And I really think that Sansa will kill Jon.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not dead set on it, but like, do not rule it out that Sansa kills Jon. I will leave it at that.
Yeah.
But yeah. And then I think Cersei will die by dragonfire.
Probably.
Because, you know, the dragons are here. That's another thing.
Yeah.
The dragons are here, and they're gonna.
The dragons are coming. And they're gonna cross attack. with the
well, let's
ships.
Get back to the let's get back to the twins, because they have a strong bond,
and they know how to get young teenage into girls to come to their house
into each other. We're talking about Jaime and Cersei twins.
Yeah, that's it.
Incest.
How
fun. So that's the world. That's my Game of Thrones predictions.
Yeah, that's where we are.
So do you think... I think the wall has to come down. I think, like, the way the season's going to play out is most of it's going to be spent on the war for Westeros.
Yeah.
And then in either the very end of the finale or in the season... Because the season finale is going to be almost an hour and a half long. I think the season finale is going to be like Battle of the Bastards, where we see the fall of the wall.
Yeah. I agree. I think this season is going to be about the battle for Westeros, and then the next season is going to really focus on the battle with the White Walkers.
Yeah, because like Jon doesn't care about the Iron Throne. Jon's like, I need as much dragonglass as I possibly can.
Yeah, I need all the dragonglass.
And then I want to make it so we don't die.
Yeah.
Also, another podcast predicted this, but do you think yes or no, Sam burns to death in the new library?
Burns to death in the new library?
Yeah, the library catches fire and he burns to death in his library.
I hope not. I like Sam. Yes. He just got there. He's going to find some shit out about dragonglass or whatnot. And that, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can't put anything past this show, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's part of what makes it so great is, like, people are like, oh, do you think this could happen? And the only response that I can have that is, like, legitimate is, I don't fucking know, possibly.
Like all the conventional endings of this season are, Jaime has to end up killing Cersei, Sansa kills Littlefinger, Jon and Dany team up together, mine the dragonglass, and Jon helps Dany take the Iron Throne so that Dany will help him fight the White Walkers. That's the conventional way this season ends. I think that last thing is the most plausible. It's obvious.
That's the one that I think is has to happen. Like they're
someone helps Dany kill Cersei so that Dany can take the throne in exchange for not dying.
Bronn has to fucking warg into a dragon. It just has to happen because I want that.
Oh, right. Bronn is still doing things.
Yeah, remember that? He showed up at the wall with what's her name? Lady
I don't care.
Yeah.
Arya's there.
Oh, yeah. She's, she fucked up the phrase.
That was a great opening to the episode. Arya's going to kill, Arya's trying to kill Cersei. Maybe she won't. Maybe she'll kill Jaime for crippling her brother.
Yeah, maybe that's what'll happen. Maybe she kills Jaime and then, Daenerys kills Cersei.
Something like that, but again, conventionality. Arya might get there and then get beaten to death by the mountain. Because, you know, she still has a zombie. Yeah, Cersei still has a zombie there.
Maybe she hooks back up with the Hound, and that's how we get Cleganebowl, because that's supposed to happen this
season. They're going
season.
In opposite directions, though.
What do you mean?
The Hound's going north in the mountains in King's Landing.
Yeah, but
I think the Hound's going to play a big role in the fall of the Wall.
Here's the thing, though. Arya is going south to King's Landing. She runs into the Hound, is like, hey, I'm going to kill Cersei.
The Hound's already further north than her, though. Like, she's... When you look at the geography, the Hound is already in the north. And Arya's already around the Riverlands area.
Curse you and your nerd knowledge of knowing where everything takes place, because I have no...
They're hundreds of miles away from each other. Because, like, if you look at the direction... The Twins is like the halfway point between the north and the south.
Right.
Arya is way past the Twins, and she's closest to the Riverlands.
Okay.
So she and the Hound are going in opposite directions. I think what Martin wanted was for Cleganebowl to happen. So if I'm correct, the Hound is still alive, and it is suggested that the people without banners, because... Big book spoilers. I don't read the books, but Lady Stoneheart is a character who is Catelyn Stark revived from the dead.
Mm.
So by the time the Brothers Without Banners find the mountain, but find the Hound, Lady Stoneheart is in charge of them because Daeric Dondarrion gave up his life so that Catelyn Stark could live.
Oh.
So if I'm correct in all of this, Lady Stoneheart is using the Brothers Without Banners to take vengeance against the Lannisters, and that's why Cleganebowl is set up in the books, so that she can send the Hound after the mountain.
Interesting. Okay.
So that is how the books are, but the show is completely different, and they're going instead to have Sir Gregor take part in fighting the White Walkers.
Interesting. Okay.
And I like that. Like, I think when the wall falls, so much rhyming, that he will be there and he'll play a big role in... They'll fall the wall.
Yeah. That'll be interesting. I just want a sequel game ball. That's all I want.
It's. I don't think it's going to happen. You have to read the books for it.
Damn it. But that's a lot of words.
I know.
A lot those of pages.
Those books are offensively enormous.
Yeah, I know. It's probably why I'll never read them.
Do you know what the most unexpected death this season of Game of Thrones will be? George R. R. Martin killing himself with food.
George R. R. Martin dying from diabetes.
Yeah. But like really violent diabetes.
Yeah, like extremely violent. Like chokes on his food, which triggers everything else, and yeah. Poor George. Anyways.
Yeah. So that's Game of Thrones. We covered all that stuff in an hour. I'll probably cut half an hour out of all this. That'll be fun.
Dope.
I don't know how I'm gonna edit all this. But thank you for coming on to Culture Vacuum, Michael. We hope to have you on. Sam, more often.
Anytime. And I will see you back on Unwatchable whenever she emerges from her cocoon.
Sometime in August. So for Unwatchable.
About three or four months.
A year and a half
or so. Yeah.
Okay.
They stuck to their thing about it being exactly.
Well, they released the first episode a year and a half after it ended, but the season is coming out in like. Shit, like 10 days. Fuck.
Yeah, I know. I'm fucking excited.
Yep. Okay. Thanks, man.
All right. No problem, buddy.
And that will bring the very first episode of the Culture Vacuum podcast to an end. Thank you so much for listening. You can expect a new episode every single Monday, so be sure to subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. And if you could help me out, go to the iTunes or Apple Podcasts app on your phone and leave us a review. So that really helps our rankings and helps other people discover the show. And also, share the show with your friends. If you want to reach out to me, I am at Holmeser Simpson on Twitter. And you can also, of course, check out the thing that started all of this, the Culture Vacuum blog. That is culturevacuum.com for all of my reviews, long think pieces, and just general thoughts in the world of pop culture. Well, that's it for this first episode. We will see you next week. Now the vacuum is blowing you out.